And welcome to another episode of the Fifth Estate Podcast. I am Jay Caruso, Deputy Editor of the Washington Examiner Magazine. I'm back with my host. Last week he was the guest. Ben Howe, author of a book, is here.
Excuse me. No. You're going to have to reintroduce me, I think.
This here is that.
It is national best-selling author, Ben Howe.
Okay. And somehow or another, your voice triggered Siri, so I don't know what that was all about. But
not even.
Hey Siri, turn off since you're on the radio.
It wasn't there. Hey, the news gal is back here too, Andrea Ruth.
I am. I decided to let you guys have, you know, a couple weeks of just chatting between yourselves. Things have been kind of tense between you two, so, you know.
No, we've been married a long time.
it's been a long marriage, yeah. All right, so our guest this week is another author, and he's also just made his way back onto political Twitter after having to take a hiatus because he was clerking for the since he was a coward. James Hassan is here, and I asked him specifically how to pronounce his last name before we got on here, because I didn't want to say James Hassan, which he says has gotten him stopped at airports.
Oh yeah, before I was in the military, I got randomly selected almost every single time.
You don't look like Siraj Hamshi. I mean, you know, why would that happen?
My boarding pass does.
There you go. All right, so before we get into...
It's Hassan?
Yep, it's Hassan.
It's Hassan, yeah.
I told Jay last night, I asked him, I said, is it Hassan or Hassan? And Jay said, I don't know, I'm going to have to ask him. And I said, well, I'm going to go with Hassan because Johnson... all that stuff.
An Irish, yeah.
Wait, he's like the smarter of the two. Woman saying
she's
right.
The Irish one, so she knows. Yeah. All right. So just very quickly, James is the author of a new book called "Stand Down: How Social Justice Warriors Are Sabotaging America's Military." But before we get into that, the more important question that we have to ask you, James, is who is the better looking Hassan, you or your brother Peter?
Oh, it's me. Hands
okay.
Down.
Who's the smarter one?
I mean, I'm gonna take the fifth on that.
But you are the better looking one. Okay,
well, he's the smarter one.
There you go. Exactly. By taking the fifth, he proved he's a smarter one, so we'll make sure we tag Peter
3D
with this
chess.
With this thing and
I don't know, man. You know, your brother has a beard and
beards are out.
No.
You know who wears beards now?
You know,
people with man buns.
He Uber eats McDonald's. There's no way that I am not the better looking one of the two. Come on.
He eats McDonald's?
Eats McDonald's.
He Ubers forget McDonald's. That is something.
I'm suddenly thinking his beard is just incidental to not going anywhere.
Never leaving the house, beard.
I don't understand this hate about beards with you, Jay, because most of the time you have one.
I don't have a beard.
But it's not a good one.
I can't grow one of those lumberjack beards where people get food caught in them and, you know, look disgusting and age themselves 10 years. You know, you get 24-year-old guys that look like they're 40. That's a great look.
Yeah.
Wait until you're actually 40,
asshole. You're at that give up age anyway, so it really doesn't matter what you do.
That's fine. I mean, I hopefully have another 25 years to live.
God, that sounds like a long time.
Years past 70, the ones nobody wants anyway.
Yeah. All right. So James, tell us about the book, what it's, you know, beyond the title, what it's about. Sure. Give us an overview.
Yeah. So I served in the Army during both of Barack Obama's terms, and the Army that I left at the end of his second term was very, very different than the Army that I joined. And I think that the American people have been kept in the dark about how this plays out within the military and what it means. And it's important because they deserve to know. And it's important for the country. So I've spent the last 12 months interviewing, you know, scores of either former generals and admirals, but basically people who were affected as this played out and kind of had a firsthand look at it.
So like, what's like a specific example of something that was different?
Give us a worst example of what you saw change.
And this happened right after I left, right? But I think I'd have to go with commanders getting lessons on male pregnancies and how to deal with that.
Oops.
What, so they can, like, deliver them in the field or something?
So that was part of the Obama administration's transgender policy, was that they did force-wide training with everybody on how to deal with, everything that goes across with that whole spectrum. So one of the vignettes that commanders had to deal with was, well, what if you have a soldier that is biologically female but identifies as male, but then stops taking their testosterone because they want to have a family and gets pregnant? So how do you deal with his pregnancy? And that was the term that they used in the actual PowerPoint.
Are we allowed to laugh at that stuff, Ben, or are we going to get in trouble?
Well, I mean, I guess the first thing that makes me think of, both Jay and I were too weak and frail to enter the military. But, I remember the military was in the news a lot more between 2002 and 2008.
Right.
Because there was a Republican in president and there was a war. And, when it was Obama, I think it was less of a topic of discussion, even though the same war was going on.
Yeah. While we were fighting that war, they were changing the military in ways that inhibits their ability to win it.
Even back during the Bush years, I remember this isn't related to the kinds of things you're talking about, but sure. I do remember the first times I started hearing about difficulties or issues, related to rules of engagement and things like that were already happening. Is this stuff you're talking about here, is it going to affect things like that as well, to make it so it's more difficult for somebody to be safe when they're out in the battlefield?
Yeah, absolutely. Because, if you're taking a specific example, the policy that they implemented over the Marine Corps' explicit and repeated objections was the integration of the infantry units in the Marine Corps. And the Marines did this year-long study where they said, okay, hey, if you want to do this, at least give us a year. And they measured everything from, injury rates to, heart rate monitors, everyone's. So they compared the performances of all male infantry squads versus gender integrated squads. And the all male squads performed better nearly 80% of the time. But more importantly, the mixed gender squads sometimes took up to 178% longer to evacuate a casualty from a vehicle. And so if that vehicle is on fire, when seconds count, minutes are deadly. So yeah, absolutely, it plays out.
Well, it's I think that if the political left or the cancel culture, woke culture, all that, I'm guessing the focus for them as it relates to you is going to be issues related to transgender. Is that mostly like with your haters that have come out? Is that mostly what they're talking about?
Yeah, that specifically, definitely. The first time I went on Tucker was, I guess, 2 years ago, and I was discussing that issue, and I got plenty of fan mail, and some of those fans are back, and it's nice.
What is their position, generally speaking? What are they? Is it just pretty emotionally driven?
Yeah,
some ideas.
It's entirely emotionally driven. It's this idea that you get the slogan, and Biden has repeated this all the time too, that everyone has a right to serve, and well, sure, everyone has a right, to join the military if they're eligible, but that's not what we're talking about here. And you have to serve under the military standards. You can't make the military conform to yours. And so really, that's, this is all looked at as far as, oh, you're inhibiting progress. And they only look at it in terms of, a social agenda versus looking at, well, in the first instance, what's the military's actual purpose? And that's to defend us all by preparing to fight and win the nation's wars, and that's it. So you ask yourself, every policy should be evaluated under the metric of, does this help us fight and win wars? If yes, we do it. If no, we don't do it. And if the answer is I don't know, then the answer is no, because it might hurt our ability.
Right. Well, yeah, it seems like the military is the originator of facts don't care about your feelings.
Yeah. With all due respect to Ben Shapiro, absolutely.
I'm sorry. Just to be clear. So you're not. This isn't about, kind of this. This kind of, it turns into a whole big thing about bigotry against LGBTQ people.
Sure.
But it's more about military readiness, and like as you said, does it prepare us to win a war? It's not necessarily, oh, this is terrible because of what it's going to do. It's not going to, you weren't going to be affected by it. By having to learn what to do in the face of a male pregnancy wasn't going to mess with you emotionally. But at the same time, they were wasting time by not doing the things, teaching you the things necessary.
Why is that a focus? Right.
Right.
And absolutely. And so that's one of the things I say in the preface to the book is that this isn't about the right politics or the wrong politics. This is just entirely leave politics out of it.
Right.
And, you know, the military is conservative as an institutional principle, not like a fiscal conservatism or a social conservatism. And, you know,
because it's based in tradition.
Right. And it's that we don't do things unless we know they're going to work and they're going to help. And we don't, you know, if it's not broken, don't fix it. But to your point, and that's, you know, people should be able to identify however they want, live and live. And so, and actually to the Trump administration's credit, that's the policy that they formed. Everyone says, oh, there's this trans ban. And actually what it is it says, be open about how you identify, live that way openly. But when you're on duty and in uniform, you have to conform to the physical readiness requirements that correspond with your biological sex.
Well,
it's for the same reason that, you know, it's problematic when you have a biological male winning, you know, female weightlifting competitions.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think also, you know, and you can correct, you know, like I said, I wasn't in the military, so correct me wrong if I'm wrong in this perception. You know, individual identity in uniform is supposed to kind of be stripped away, right? You're more about the structure and the command structure. That doesn't mean that as an individual, you don't have your individual. I mean, they move families with military all the time. Nobody's saying don't have a life or a sense of individuality outside of the military. But once you put on the uniform and are performing your duties, you're part of a command structure and your individual identity is kind of meaningless and it can get in the way in this situation.
Right.
Is that accurate?
No, that's spot on, because we would actually use the phrase in the Army, don't be an individual, when you're telling someone like, hey, get with the program, stop thinking about yourself. And the Marines actually have a more colorful phrase. And what's the rule on language on this podcast?
Oh, it's fucking great.
All right, perfect. So the Marines call it, like, if that's what you're doing, then you're an OFP Marine, which stands for own fucking program. You know, and that's, the whole point is don't, you know, don't be an individual, like you're saying.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and what the progressive focus on, you know, social justice or, you know, progressive ideals versus military readiness does is that it inverts the traditional military ethos. You mm-hmm. go from, you know, you conform to the military to, well, the military conforming now to your needs,
right,
which has never been the
yeah.
case.
Well, and it seems like that flies in the, I mean, you know, I don't think anybody on this podcast would disagree that we've become a pretty me-focused culture.
Right.
And so, you know, I guess where I would have concerns is that there's a, there's probably an openness even among people who could be convinced otherwise. Somebody could be convinced about what the arguments you're making in this book. It seems like somebody without all the information could be convinced, no, we should do this and that in the military, because they are thinking more culturally how we are as Americans, as opposed to considering how the military functions and has always functioned.
No, I think that's exactly right. And that's something I've encountered just talking to people about the book, is that, you know, the military only treats it at, or the media only treats it at a very surface level in terms of, oh, you know, people aren't being allowed to do X or Y. And so then everyone's emotional instinct is, oh, like, why are we banning these, you know, patriotic people, or why are we, you know, forcing people to do X or Y? And you have to recalibrate that into a very unique structure with a very unique mission in society. But that's not how the Obama administration looked at, you know, the military at all. For them, it was just a blunt force tool for pushing broader social change. And, you know, an example
he had,
of that,
you know, he had advisors around him and he had the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Like, what were they saying to him?
So advisors versus the Joint Chiefs of Staff, I don't know if you can put them in the same category, because he definitely didn't listen to the Joint Chiefs of Staff. But he was surrounded by a bunch of people who were similarly minded. And a lot of these changes were also just pushed by those he appointed. So, for instance, when they were, you know, not to keep going back to that, the transgender thing, because there are plenty of other issues. But when they were announcing that policy, the Undersecretary of the Navy, who is Anthony Curta, said that, you know, basically this is going to happen. And a senior chaplain in the Marine Corps was working in the commandant's office, approached him and said, hey, you know, we have concerns about this, and laid them out. And Curta just responded, you know, there will be mixed genitalia in military bathrooms, showers, and billeting. And it's good for America. And this Marine, you know, this as Marines do, said, well, wow, sir, do you really think that's going to make us better at war fighting? And Curta just responded, well, that's the way it is.
Oh, wow. Andrew, you know, has a question.
About that is, I don't even know how they how do they comport that mentality with their secondary mentality that all of the Vietnam vets were raping children in other countries? Like, there's often a rape culture idea that I see the left also pushing when it comes to the military. But then they want to put women in the same bathroom with them? Like, how do these two ideas align? It's like, right, two stereotypes that they or two narratives that completely conflict with one another.
No, they absolutely do. And, you know, sexual assault in the military is a very serious thing that deserves to be addressed. So not downplaying that in the least. But, you know, you have Kirsten Gillibrand, who, thank God, is, you know, no longer embarrassing herself, but on the presidential campaign. But she was pushing at the same time, you know, this program to end or to combat sexual assaults in the military, and at the same time was also, you know, openly advocating for this policy that, you know, has mixed genitalia and open bay showers. You know, how do you, right, you know, it's just cognitive dissonance.
Right.
It is, man.
All right. Jeez. Andrea, you got a question?
Yeah, just going back to, you know, the fact that you were in the military during the Obama years and the whole safety and readiness issue. So during the Obama years, you guys had, the military had sequestration issue, you know, constantly being a threat and finally coming in. When you were talking about these training programs and, you know, for transgender issues and other issues that have nothing to do, that are political and social, but not anything to do with military readiness and safety. But when we see, so you guys are spending time and resources, specifically resources, money resources, it takes money to right, you know, run these programs and train people on transgender awareness or you know, comfortability.
We have a chief diversity officer at the Air Force Academy, et cetera.
Yeah, and you're looking at what happened in the Pacific Fleet, and they were talking about sequestration being a problem there. I mean, we had military men actually dying because of accidents in the Pacific Fleet because they weren't being trained in these other areas. So do you just want to touch on that a little
bit? Yeah, I'm really glad that you brought that up, because that's something that I talk about, you know, in the first chapter of my book, because it, you know, it's what made all of these efforts, all, you know, social efforts, all the more egregious, because it was happening at a time when the force as a whole was starved for resources, and, you know, and was, you know, in serious disrepair in some ways. So the Navy specifically, some of the people that I interview and you know, quote in the book, you know, were admirals or, you know, naval officials in the Pentagon who were intimately involved in trying to raise the red flags for, you know, about Seventh Fleet specifically. And, you know, as one of the admirals I spoke to said, you know, you're focusing on all of these things while the, you know, ships are literally falling apart at the pier and we don't have enough men to man, you know, these ships. So that Seventh Fleet accident, one of the reasons it happened is because they had overworked and undermanned crews, and they didn't have enough time to train them because they, you know, they were lacking resources and for a number of reasons. But so the young sailor who was, you know, piloting the ship was using the mechanism for steering for the first time. Instead of using a kind of a more manual device, he was using something that looked like an iPad. And so, you know, and because he wasn't familiar with that system, and because, you know, there was that severe readiness issue, that's what happened. And so one of the sailors on the USS John McCain, only weeks before that accident, actually, you know, sent up a you know, told one of his supervisors, you know, sir, it's only a matter of time before something bad happens here. And so that's what makes this all more egregious. While the Navy was falling apart, Ray Mabus, who's the Secretary of the Navy, was focused on you know, eliminating the term man from all of their job titles and creating gender-neutral uniforms. Yeah, just a totally just criminal. And that's actually,
Yeah,
just a criminal misplaced priority.
One of the other areas, I think, because like you said, you know, you're getting a lot of focus on the transgender stuff, but there's other things that I find much more fascinating, like the climate warriors. There's a quote in here you have from Jeffrey Goldberg of The Atlantic. It says, ISIS is not an existential threat to the United States. Climate change is a potential existential threat to the entire world if we don't do something about it. Number one, I find it remarkable when anybody determines that an enemy who's intent on destroying us is not an existential threat. Maybe I'm using the wrong terminology here, but a threat doesn't necessarily mean they're capable of pulling it off, right? They are, their intent is to destroy us. That is by nature an existential threat.
Right.
But then the other side of it is the conflation with an issue like climate change. I don't understand. I mean, I guess now maybe I do with Trump wanting to nuke hurricanes, but like, I don't know where the idea comes that the military would really, was it just about changing the way military does things in order to lower their carbon footprint?
There's a mindset change across the board. That's the term that they used. And it's funny that you brought up that distinction between, or that dichotomy between ISIS and climate change. Because, Ben Rhodes, who we all love to dunk on Twitter, said basically that, ISIS is, he refused to say that ISIS was a bigger threat than climate change the day before the San Bernardino attacks, where an ISIS supporter killed a bunch of Americans. So part of that focus was, it was environmentally driven. So Ray Mabus, who is honestly just one of the villains of that administration, he served for all 8 years. But before he joined the administration, he was a huge, left-wing environmental activist. In fact, his bio, that's one of the things they cite in his bio, that he got a Greenpeace Award. And so that's just kind of where they were, or some similar organization. And that's just where they were coming from. And so, one of the admirals that I talked to, who is a, this guy was a 2-star, and he said, they're worried about fucking green fuel. Meanwhile, the ships that are supposed to run on that green fuel are pulling apart and can't deploy on time. And, it was, to use an example outside the Navy, the Army War College started, putting climate change on one of their threat assessment things. So I talked to an Army colonel who said, I went to the Army War College and my final graded threat assessment was climate change. He said, I thought I was going to get how to do an urban operation or, counterinsurgency, and I got fucking climate change. So, those are their words.
This is where my mind goes when I hear things like what he said. If you really make the case, okay, so we have the most powerful military in the world, and these guys were saying that climate change is going to be listed on as one of the threats and is an existential threat to the rest of the world. Is this not the kind of language that would precede military action, as in, we're going to invade a country so their carbon footprint will shrink?
Look at that. If not in real life, then at least a Jerry Bruckheimer movie.
But doesn't it feel like
that's what they're
if the whole world's going to end.
If the world's going to end in 12 years, we got to do something to forcefully stop India and China from being.
I was just going to say that because Ben Rhodes was talking about how we need to spend trillions of dollars a year. And I went to the Yale's environmental performance index, mm-hmm. and the United States is ranked, with the number one economy in the world, is ranked 27th in the world on that scale, which is, we have France is like number two, and we have a population five times the size of that country. China, ranked 122. India is ranked 177. I mean, they're doing the most damage right now. And so it's an interesting question. Some people say it's a false question, but it is. What are you going to do to force China and India to do this short of a military invasion?
What's funny to me is that, I am no stranger. Jay, you're no stranger. James, you've been a stranger to this kind of rhetoric for the last year because you're a coward. But you've got, there's plenty of things that Trump has said that I have said are dangerous.
Right.
And when I read this, this mentality that I know that particular quote was from Jeffrey Goldberg, but as you said, it was basically repeated by Ben Rhodes. When you have that kind of a mentality and they're saying essentially that same thing, that is dangerous. Like what they're saying is dangerous. because they're putting the idea in people's heads that force will become necessary to deal with this, and that the military has a role in that. What do they think the military's role would be other than to be the enforcers of it?
I guess if you were to ask them, they would probably duck the question and say that the military's goal is to totally become carbon neutral. You know, so that's what Liz Warren. That's what Elizabeth Warren's plan. You know, yeah. Well, Elizabeth Warren published a plan saying we'll use the military to fight climate change. That's one of, you know, she has like a million plans on her website. That's one of them. And so she talks about, you know, we'll make the entire force, you know, carbon neutral, which if you understand anything about the military vehicles, it means like basically you're accomplishing the Green New Deal version of military vehicles, you know, because you have to retrofit everything. And that's a drop in the bucket compared to what, you know, Russia or China and India are emitting. So basically, we're unilaterally disarming in terms of what we're doing and, you know, prioritizing for our military. But I mean,
well, and it's not even an issue of, you know, I know that people would call our conversation already. They would say they had a big climate denier conversation. We haven't even addressed the realities of any of it. It's not
no.
Climate
that's,
change.
Right.
It's about putting our resources.
It's either that or the, well, I guess they just think we should do nothing.
Right. Exactly.
Now, what we should do, James, I think you'd be on board with this, solar powered submarines.
Ooh, I like that. I mean, come on, they got water turbines. Why do they even need electricity in these things?
Just drop it in there. It'll figure itself out.
Yeah. Right. These things just happen naturally.
Yeah, no, I mean,
I just find the whole, I don't understand how people can speak in such apocalyptic language. I mean, can you imagine, for instance, take an issue that could be technically described as a threat to humanity, like lowering birth rates. You know, can you imagine if Trump came out and said the lowering birth rates are becoming a crisis, and if we don't do something, humanity will go extinct?
You would have Handmaid's Tale comparisons in like 3 seconds. Issue. Yeah, yeah, it's absurd. And back to Andrea's point, though, about where your priorities are during sequestration. You know, during 2000, basically during sequestration, during the beginning parts of it, they were you know, spending enormous amounts of money on domestic green projects for buildings, right? So one of the examples that I pointed out in the book, just because it's so absurd, is that at Camp Pendleton for the Marine Corps, they you know, created a pebble-strewn rock garden versus outside one of the barracks instead of you know, a lawn, because it's more environmentally friendly. And think about, well, the Marines are right now, you know, or they were cannibalizing their old aircraft from the boneyard so they could fly. But, you know, thank God they had that pebble-strewn rock garden, you know?
But you raise an interesting idea, which is that the military should start looking into opening a landscaping company. And then they could make a lot more money for the military by just being hired out to make, you know, water features and stuff for people's backyards. They're very pretty.
Yeah, you should pitch Elizabeth Warren on that.
And environmentally friendly.
Exactly.
All right, so
that's scary. This is all very scary.
Yeah,
it's like, you know, I like the way you said that this isn't about the right or wrong politics. It's kind of just about the existence of politics, right?
Yeah, no, that's exactly it. You know, you talk about scary. So one of the kind of what I close with in that the preface of the book is a quote from Mattis, who writing about all these issues at the end of 2015 was saying that he feared that our political class is not paying a price for diminishing combat effectiveness, and the public is essentially being kept in the dark about it. So he said, the quote was, an uninformed public is allowing, you know, social justice changes that will only be evident, the harm of which will only be evident in the aftermath of military failure. Mm-hmm. And I think that's, you know, if that's what we're talking about here, it's...
Theoretically, if there were cultural forces from the right that were trying to push their own politics into it, even if we agreed with those politics, I still wouldn't want them to be a factor of military life. And I've known guys who are conservatives who are in the military, and they have certain rules about, I mean, Schlichter, when he was ever, I don't remember what it was that he was doing because he was National Guard, but when he was in certain situations, he would not criticize Obama. because he's you know, he spent a lot of the other time criticizing Obama, but he was like,
no, absolutely, this, yeah,
to be non-political.
Yeah. And it was funny when I left the military and like a year later, you know, I was writing stuff. At first, it was almost uncomfortable because I'd spent the last several years not speaking publicly about politics, even to people outside of my family, really.
Power.
But no, you're absolutely right, because, you know, if there was, trying to hypothesize something from the right,
I know,
maybe like, you know, like
thinking of something.
Well, yeah. So maybe if somebody had some kind of weird, you know, thought that women should just not be in the military at all or something, I'd be like, you know, as if something that was something agreed with, but I'd be like, absolutely not.
What if it was a military requirement that even though abortion is legal, women in the military aren't allowed to have one? I'd be against that.
Yeah, I mean, your point is basically we're having a hard time to find like a really good example, in part because conservatism in general is kind of, hey, leave things alone.
Right.
But what you're saying is kind of what I try to get at in the book. And, you know, there are a lot, you know, we tossed out a few of these examples, but they're strewn throughout the book of all of these things. When you just look at them, they're absurd on their face when you are applying them to an institution that is supposed to be designed only to fight and win wars. I mean, if you ask the American people, would you rather have a military that is spending time being sensitive to pronoun use, or spending time, you know, focus on, you know, anti, you know, well, we'll just leave the pronoun use one out there, you know, or would you rather have them spend that time focusing on, you know, actually out in the field training? I'm pretty sure they would take the second. I mean, so when I was in, we had to pull guys out of the field if they hadn't taken their equal opportunity training. And that was only months before we deployed. And, you know, so I'm sitting there, you know, as an officer in an infantry company thinking, you know, wait a second, like, we're going to go to war here pretty soon, and you're telling me I had to send guys back from the field because they haven't taken EO training? And, you know. Right.
Crazy. And now, just, were you in any firefights when you were over there?
I wasn't in, like, a... You know, the unit was in some, but I was.
Okay. Were you in the shit?
Were you in the?
Yeah.
No. So a lot of times, you know, we talk about politics downstream from culture, and how culture and popular culture can express something that's a true sentiment. So you've probably seen Black Hawk Down.
Sure.
Right. And so the character Hoot at one point says, "Once that first bullet goes past your head, politics and all that shit just goes right out the window." I mean, is that the kind of sense that most people, most of the guys and even the women there who are probably,
yeah, 100%.
Don't really give a crap
what they're talking about
home on CNN when, you know, right, we're sitting here taking fire.
Right. No, that's exactly it. That's exactly
and
it.
So that, and so that just brings it about back to what you were talking about, that because of that, they probably shouldn't be concerned about gender sensitivity training and you know what happens when a man gets pregnant, because basically you're taking time away from saying when the bullets start flying, these people need to be ready to fight more than, mm-hmm, anything else.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so it's, and again, it's not a political thing. If that's something, if they want to do that when they get out and they're, you know, and they're no longer part of the military, then fine, go ahead and do that all you want. But I happen to agree with you. I think it's a kind of waste of resources, right, to do that.
And, you know,
and time.
Right. And so, like, we would go out to, you know, patrol outside the wire and coast Afghanistan. And, you know, and there was never a time that I was walking outside the wire thinking, oh, you know, worrying about people's political opinions or, you know, immutable traits or, you know, who they loved or anything. It's just like, hey, you know, our comms up.
Yeah. Like, yeah. Yeah.
So.
All right.
Well, you know what's funny to me is that in terms of the psychology involved of people who think this stuff isn't bad, I always notice how willing people are to ignore the people that are in the best position to know when they have an agenda, but more specifically, when they have an agenda that they otherwise don't understand affects them too. So they don't really make the connection between our safety, our lives, and our prosperity, and the fact that we have the military protecting us. But if you transfer it over to, like, you know, a hospital, they do expect exactly what you're asking for in the military. We have that big story right now about the woman who was forced to participate in an abortion, mm-hmm, you know, because the idea is, hey, There's no room for all of these disagreements here. We have a job to do. You took the job. You know, you conform to what we need because there's a more important mission, which is the medical. And they're totally on board with that. They think that's great because they've been to hospitals. They may have to go to a hospital. Like, everybody feels that effect. But with the military, they don't make the connection. And so it's this other thing. And then they don't understand the implications and they ignore the advisors.
Right. And, you know, so part of my purpose in this and trying to emphasize is that it's, you know, the book itself is an act of journalism in terms of going out and finding all of this information and talking to all these sources and channeling all the experiences of, you know, these, you know, 2 and 3 stars or these infantry company commanders or anybody that's affected by it. But it's just so radically different from any kind of domestic, government agency where you could be, you know, kind of looking at the examples you were talking about.
Awesome. So, do you have time to hang around and do the news?
Yeah, I know.
All right. Andrea, it is time for the news. What do you have for us? Anything good?
Music?
No, we're not recording live, so Ben's going to put the music in after.
Muzak.
Yeah, I'm also going to edit that little part.
Yeah, you have to.
Yeah. So we can start with going back to, you know, because we've been talking about climate change. So Columbia Journalism Review has announced that 170 news outlets will sign an agreement to cover climate change because, you know, they haven't been covering it before now. So more than 170 news outlets from around the world with a combined audience of hundreds of millions of people have now signed up for Covering Climate Now, a project co-founded by CJR and The Nation, aimed at strengthening the media's focus on the climate crisis. Now, with Dorian, you know, heading up Florida. Jay, your kids are all down there. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like
Jay has 57 children.
Do you feel like we're not
that I know of?
Do you feel like, you know, do any of you feel like climate change or you know, any kind of, you know, weather event isn't covered enough by the media? And is this just kind of silly?
Well, hurricanes are always going to get, and especially. It's almost as if, and you hate to say this, but it's almost, I doubt anyone's going to disagree with me. It's like you almost have the sense of when there's a huge snowstorm, when there's possible hurricanes, weather people become like stars, and that's their time to shine. And it's almost you get the sense that some people, not that they want, but they would almost like to see some, you know, a Category 4 hurricane slam the coast of Florida just to prove a point. Now, the thing is, there hasn't been a hurricane that strong since Hurricane Andrew, which was back in 1990, I think. So since then, you know, I lived there in 2004. We survived. I think there were like 3 hurricanes that hit. You know, I lived just north of Daytona Beach. 3 hurricanes that hit the area in about 3 weeks. There was Hurricane Charlie, Hurricane Jean, and one other one. And Jean was the one that finally like knocked our power out because it was sitting over the Atlantic for like 3 days. But you see this, and they're trying to get people to panic because if, of course, it does happen to stay at a Category 4 strength, it will invoke the climate change alarmists. And, you know, we talked about this before when we were talking to James about his book. We're not sitting here denying it. I don't deny it. But at the same time, there's the alarmism that says, you know, if we don't do anything, we're going to be dead in 10 years. And that every storm that takes place is a result of climate change. And if it's not doing something, it's a result of climate change. If you get 55 mm-hmm. snowstorms in January, it's climate change. Well, we only got 1 snowstorm this year. Well, that's because of climate change. Everything is, or everything that happens or doesn't happen is because of climate change. So,
well, and it's also just so like the idea, let's say the world was, maybe let's say they're right. Like, and first of all, what's funny about even saying they're right is that that's not, even though that's how AOC and others have said it, that isn't even what those scientists said.
Right.
What they said was, if we don't do something in X amount of time, it'll be irreversible. And then there was some other future date where, you know, we all die. but it wasn't literally that it ends now, but that's how everybody describes it now because of her, and a few others. But what's amazing to me is, like, let's say that that's true. How in the world is your best way of dealing with that to treat people asking questions about it as though their questions are not worthy of consideration? Like, if
people asking for realistic
urgent,
solutions versus, you know,
yeah,
like
it would seem like they would want to convince people.
Yeah, well, or at least, you know, like, why not find at least common ground on free market solutions, or, you know, something other than, you know, retrofitting every single building in the United States?
Well, and that's what Marco Rubio said when he was asked. I can't even remember when it was, but it was just in the last, like, you know, 24 months. But, you know, he basically said, like, look, I'm not up for destroying an entire state's economy to deal with a rise in this, you know, oceans that hasn't come to fruition, and the rise is negligible. And why should you sink an entire state's economy because of that? You have rational people speaking on this, and people like Greta Thunberg, who says she has no tolerance for adults who ask questions about climate change. You know,
That's really going to get people. Why are you even coming to an event that's designed to discuss it if you've already said you won't
have no tolerance,
entertain any conversation? It's retarded.
And if we're going to talk about this, though, like, also the whole Greta Thunberg thing is raising the issue of, you know, people are kind of weaponizing these kids and or at least using them is probably the better way to do it. But, you know, you're putting this, I think she's, you know, suffers, has autism, or, you know, and
so autism.
She
had a disorder.
Yeah. And so she's fixating on, you know, so, and then you're saying everyone listen to this kid, but then if anyone doesn't or has different ideas, and you're saying, oh, well, you can't disagree or attack her because you're a kid, and nobody should be attacking her at all. But, you know, they just create this double-edged.
Oh, yeah. Somebody
listen to the kids that we agree with.
Yeah. Right? Somebody had said that yesterday. Somebody had said, you know, why are you attacking her? Just a child. And it's like, oh, so we're supposed to sit there. Oh, because it was actually Tom Nichols, of all people, who said, I don't really pay attention to what teenagers say, so it doesn't matter. And somebody was like, well, you know, why are you attacking her? Because she's just a child. And somebody replied to him saying, so we're supposed to sit there and just sit at the feet of these kids who say these things because she's a child, but you're not allowed to turn around and question what they say because that would be mean because she's a child and now you're a bully, you know?
Yeah, that's the thing, though. I don't listen to younger people that I agree with.
Oh, me neither.
It's like, you know, I'm glad you picked up on this, bro, but, like, you've got nothing to teach me.
I mean, I sit there and I snicker at half of the people that I talk to that I agree with on Twitter, especially when they're under 25. Like, you guys don't know shit.
There's a lack of, not to sound like a curmudgeon, but I was pretty.
Oh, you're pretty curmudgeon-y.
You are
not as bad as your brother.
I generally relented on questions of mentorship and things like that. You know, I just assumed people knew better because they were older. And I that didn't mean I took everything. I was, you know, it's not that you never question anything as a kid, but you do at some point have to go, I don't have all the answers because I'm not old enough to have them, and I'm trying to learn.
Right,
they're not here to teach us.
Yeah,
that's called turning 30.
Except algebra, here to teach.
You pissed off the math.
You've done a lot of in the military, right, James?
What, algebra?
Yeah.
No, deference and respect.
Yes.
Yeah. Yes. Well, and nobody, you know, the funny part is everyone's saying, why are you, you know, like, attacking this kid? And I don't know if any person is doing that at all. I know a decent person would, but people have a right to criticize the adults who are, you know.
So let me get this straight. You spent a year not commenting on politics and adults, and then you come back and start attacking a 16-year-old child. What kind of a man?
Oh, man.
All right. Andrea, what else do you have in the news?
Well, I have something that has been near and dear to Jay's and my hearts because we watched it, I think, on Tuesday night, the night it came out.
Grey's Anatomy?
No. Yeah. No, but so Dave Chappelle has a new stand-up special on Netflix. It's called Sticks and Stones. To Jay and I, we decided to go and watch it later in the evening because we saw all of these, just, you know, Vice has an article called You can definitely skip Dave Chappelle's new Netflix special, Sticks and Stones. National Review's Kyle Smith wrote an article saying that it wasn't that good. What actually came out of it was a lot of people, when the, you know, it's one of those things where thou dost protest too much. It is, in my opinion, a great, like, anti-woke, but not subversively, as the Federalist said, subversively pro-life.
It's no.
Yeah, he's not on our side politically.
I know. And I hate it how people do this.
They and people shouldn't do that. He's just a comedian.
Yeah. So, people who say it's pro-life, I'm like, dude, you're hearing what you want to hear. It's okay that he doesn't agree with everything you're saying. Be happy about the parts he did and laugh at the parts he didn't.
But it seems like even the and so now going out of my news girl role, having an opinion that even the people that normally are kind of against woke culture got their backs up about the fact, you know, that he kind of made jokes about Michael Jackson's accusers in the Michael Jackson documentary on HBO and things like that. Those types of things, like, it is one of those stand-up routines that honestly was very funny. In, again, I have to keep saying, in my opinion, I shouldn't keep saying that, but it is very
just
funny.
We know it's your opinion, so just say it's funny. And if anybody disagrees, they're stupid.
Wear a shirt that says retweets aren't endorsements.
In a very Carlin-esque, you know, way, and Richard Pryor way, he doesn't care, and he's not trying to, but he does, you know, take things to their logical ends. Unless you've got some kind of, you know, dog that or that you're having the fight or something like that, you're not, this is just, he's just speaking what he thinks, and it's just funny. Unlike, you know, Jay, who did you say the Hannah Gatt, his favorite comedian?
Yeah, he named the 2018, the same writer from Vice named the 2018 comedian of the year, that Hannah, what's her name?
Gadsby.
Taylor, yeah.
Is the Vice writer.
Yeah. The one who said that she doesn't want to be funny.
And did one stand-up routine.
That's on brand, yeah, then, for this guy.
And somebody wrote a review of her stand-up saying, you know, she went through this entire thing. There were no gags. There were nothing. Nobody was laughing. And the guy was like, only the best comedians could do something like that. I'm like, only the best comedians can have an audience not laugh? I mean, really?
I'm pretty sure I could accomplish that.
Yeah, yeah. I think any one of us could. So,
the thing that rattled some of the right with the MJ stuff is I just wonder if these people watched Chappelle's show, because what that routine was very much in line with what he's done before.
Right.
The joke that he's saying, they're like, he's making fun of kids. No, he is making fun of himself. He's saying, I love MJ, and honestly, I don't believe these accusations, but I also know that no amount of evidence would convince me against my own bias. And so he's making fun of that.
Right.
And he did that on the show when they had the whole court thing, where they were saying to him, you know, but what about this and what about this? And he was like coming up with these ridiculous ways to rationalize it away. And then they said, okay, so you're saying you'd let your child have a sleepover with him? And he goes, hell no. Like, because he knows. He knows, but at the same time, he'll go out of his way to rationalize it. And so that's the joke.
Right.
He was making fun of how far people will go to confirm their own biases.
I mean, right. And the thing that I'd said is that it was not only a major pushback against,
that's what I think the joke
against woke culture, but it was also a very, very much needed defense of stand-up comedy, which is an art. Which is an art. There's lots of stand-up comedians out there. Why do you think there's only probably about every year that you can ask people to name? They can probably name five or six, especially current ones, not necessarily Eddie Murphy or Richard Pryor, but current ones that are famous off the top of their head, because most aren't as funny as those guys. And it's an art. It's an art form, and you're always going to find somebody that's going to be offensive. So I think Chappelle pushed the envelope, but I think that's good because
He did it in a Carlin-esque way.
Well, if you're trying to, I mean, it's almost impossible to do comedy without offending somebody. The only person I can think of who does that is Jim Gaffigan, and he's got like his own little thing going on.
Yeah, but even so, Andrew and I were just talking about that last night when he was talking about in Noble Ape, when he said how they don't use the before hospital. And he goes, I've done the research. And he goes, you know why British people don't say the before hospital? Because they're dicks. and then he immediately said, now, I would never sit there and do those jokes there. So, I mean, even somebody would probably find that a little bit of offensive, not in the Dave Chappelle way. But that's how it is, and I always go back to what Jerry Seinfeld said when somebody asked him if he was going to apologize for anything he'd ever said, and he said no. He goes, they're jokes. They're not real. Yeah, so that's the whole point. And Kyle Smith took issue with Chappelle talking about some drug addict breaking into his home, and he's like, well, I kind of suspect that Chappelle has a much better security system that somebody wouldn't.
Well, oh my God, are you serious?
No, yes, I'm serious, and I like Kyle, but it was just absurd. It's like, well, yeah, we understand that, but where's the joke if he's talking about what kind of ammo he has in his shotgun, if he just goes downstairs and the guy's like, he never made it in.
They had the time stone. Like, make a YouTube video about all of the plot holes in Chappelle's stand-up routine.
Yeah. Did you shoot anyone? No, well, Simply Safe took care of us, so we didn't have to worry about it. Yeah, I mean, there's no joke if the guy is not in his house
That's
trying to get his
me,
money.
Is people who don't understand, like, they're... What they're attacking is what made it funny.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, exactly.
It's like when people, they criticize fiction, they're like, oh, that's pretty coincidental. You know, that seems unrealistically coincidental that this or that would happen. I'm like, yeah, it is. That's why it's a story, is because it was interesting. If the things that we all predicted were going to happen, that normally happen, why would we want to watch a movie about that? That's
right.
The whole point.
Right. It's always that way. So it's just kind of
people
absurd,
nitpicking.
So.
And, you know, there's the people on Twitter that came out to do the contrarian takes. I liked it, but it wasn't his best work.
Yeah.
I was just like, dude, what are you, a comedian? Like, get on stage and understand their mentality before you talk about it. I feel fine, like, talking about what I think his jokes meant or saying what I think is funny and not funny. But I don't know what it's like to be a comedian. I don't know what he deals with or how he comes up with his bits or what he was hoping to get out of the audience. I can only guess.
Right.
Well, that's Twitter in a nutshell, though. I mean, like, pick the greatest people, you know, the greatest artists in history, and if bring them into 2019 on Twitter, you'd have some guy being like, I don't know, it's not that great.
that Da Vinci work is okay.
Yeah, I was literally about to say Da Vinci.
Yeah. I've painted my ceiling before, too. What's the big deal?
He started Sticks and Stones. In the first 5 minutes, he said exactly what he expected from his audience. He looked at them and said, you guys are the worst people.
and it was so telling that, when he made those comments about, you know, I'm going to come after you. I'm going to get, who's that? And people were like, Trump. And it was just like, you proved his point in that few seconds where you started yelling out Trump.
The thing I have loved the most about his last two specials, which have both gotten that kind of pushback from, especially in regards to transgender stuff,
right,
is the watching the audience. There's no reason to think, given the cities he's in, that these are people who would vote for Trump or something. Like, these are probably more left-leaning.
Yes,
I mean, like,
right.
I think that's a safe guess. And if I'm overgeneralizing, then fine, half of them. But 100% of them are laughing.
Right.
And it almost feels like there's like this release when you watch them. Like, they're nervous
absolutely.
At first. And then they're like, oh, God, I can finally laugh about
this. Yeah, well, they're in a place where they're allowed to laugh. You know, it'd be interesting, though, to see if anybody recognized someone from The Office as being in that thing and say, you know, I saw you laughing at Dave Chappelle the other day. What's the matter with you?
Well, it is
Human
already
Resources?
Because, you know, it doesn't help that, for instance, conservatives are trying to adopt him. Because they're just, it's like the tribalism takes over everything all the time. There's no tribe here, guys.
No.
Like, stop trying to adopt him or make him your enemy or any of those other things. There's no tribal in this situation.
Yeah.
And I don't know how people, he's so famous. He's been around for so long. How do people not know this? I have been watching him since the 90s. He hasn't changed. Like, how do they not know this about
Right,
him?
Exactly. He's been telling the same jokes over and over for decades, and just 5 minutes ago, everyone decided it was problematic.
Yeah.
Do you remember what he said about, what's her name? Monica Lewinsky? And he was saying that he blamed Hillary. He was like, or no, that was Chris Rock. His was that he felt sorry for her. And he said, I mean, and the audience all booed him because it was the late 90s and they were still loving Clinton. And they all booed, no, they don't feel sorry for him. And he was just like, man, that's just jealousy. He was like, everybody in here has had at least one dick they regret. And I bet he wasn't the president of the United States. And it's like, that was controversial at the time.
But, you know, it's like I told Jay the other day when we were talking about Chappelle. Chappelle's been at the same place saying the same things since the 90s. And Adam Carolla is another person who's been kind of like adopted by the right. Adam Carolla is not pro-life. He's not religious. He's right. not. He's just been saying the same things since the 90s. And he plays clips from him in the 90s saying the exact same things. Back in the 90s, he was this uber liberal MTV guy, Comedy Central guy. And now he's seen as a conservative. He's like, look, I'm just saying the same things I've always said. And now you guys have all changed your, you know, right. how you're going about it.
You've changed. Exactly. Yep.
Yeah.
All right. So that's going to do about an hour here. James, thank you for being on.
Yeah. Thank you very much. This is great.
Yeah. And everybody go out, make sure that you buy James' book. It just came out
Tuesday.
No, just came out Tuesday. So you can go and buy his book, Stand Down, How Social Justice Warriors are Sabotaging America's Military. Knock Ben's book back.
Yeah.
And, you know.
Oh, he's already ahead of me. Are you kidding?
Okay, there you go. There you go. See that? All right. And, yeah, so continue to check that out. And we're happy to report. I guess it's okay to report this. James has now moved to the D.C. area.
Hell yeah.
You know, let me say, by the way, I am beating him in Christian history section.
Oh, okay.
I just want to point that out.
Yeah. You know what? I cut that part of the book, and I've been regretting it ever since.
But you're not beating him in geography because you're still down there in Bumbleweed, South Carolina, while he's moved here to the city.
I kick your ass in algebra, too.
You guys, in your blue-check journalists in your D.C. bubble.
Hey, man, I'd love to get a blue check if you want to help me out with that while I'm here.
I'm sorry, we don't do that here.
Jerry doesn't even have a blue check yet.
Yeah, of course not.
Oh, Jerry, by the way, Jerry Dunleavy, I saw him when I was in D.C., and he said that he might be getting one. I was like, well, that he told me he had been put in, like, because of his position at the Washington Examiner, like, they had said that they could probably get him one, and he turned it down, and I was like, what are you doing some kind of, like, hippie, I don't want to be part of the establishment crowd?
Yeah, I'm the, you know, you're the working man type.
I don't want my career to make. I don't
He's
want
it
to
be easier
for my career to reach out to people.
Well, we should definitely out you, Ben, because even though you live in South Carolina, you will be in D.C. next week, and so James, you will have to. If we go out, James,
let's do it. Has to go out. Oh, and just another. I don't know if anybody who I know, Andrew and I know him, Mike Glenn, who is a reporter for the Houston Chronicle.
Yeah.
He's a military guy. Is moving to D.C. as well, as he is now going to be a reporter. Reporter at the Washington Times covering the Pentagon.
So have you moved there already, James?
Yeah, I mean, my apartment's just full of boxes right now because, you know, I moved in about a week ago.
I'll make
right before all this stuff started.
Yeah, I'll make note.
Well, now
of the
that you're part of the author club, you know, obviously you have a lot more money and you're going to be getting, you know, a nice mansion in Northern Virginia.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yep.
There you go.
Books on military policy, man.
There you go. See, I'll make sure that I'll lecture Grant Addison on the fact that, you know, Grant just moved and he said he couldn't come in because he couldn't find pants. And here's James. He's in here. He's there.
I have pants on.
And he has pants on. So, I mean, although nobody would know if he decided to take them off and stroll around the office. But,
oh, gosh.
I don't even know what you're saying there, but okay.
All right, everyone. So make sure you check out his book. So for Andrew Ruth and Ben Howe and James Hassan, I'm Jake Russo. We'll see you next time on The Fifth Estate.
Fumbling his confidence and wondering why the world has passed him by.